lovelies, and welcome to Out on the Edge, where co-hosts Judy McCord, Robin Hamilton, and Betty Priu, three queer weird sisters Shakespeare could not have foreseen, present an all-ages tour of what it's like to be gay and gray in North Carolina in these interesting times. For today's episode, September 22nd, 2025, our guest is our co-host Robin Elise Hamilton, a dear friend and able partner here out on the edge. We look forward to hearing about your new unique journey, Robin. First, a shout out to our host, WCOMLP, Chapel Hill Carborough at 103.5 FM. We are brought to you by the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging. We are deeply grateful for their guidance and support. You can listen to the show live at 103.5 FM or stream it live at WCOMFM.org, Monday afternoons, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern. Archived shows can be found on the Orange County Department on Aging website at www.orangecountync.gov/OOTE. You'll also find a wide range of resources and services available through the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging. We honor that the town of Carborough and surrounding land was originally part of the Saponi people's territory, which also included Eno, Tutelo, and Shikori Nation. Take it away.
Okay. Again, our guest today is the fabulous Robin Elise Hamilton, one of the three show's co-hosts. Robin is already very rich in life experience, and correct me if I'm wrong, in her early 70s at this point?
Yes.
Okay,
cool.
You're not supposed to reveal a woman's age, but this is an elder show, so we're
going to say that. I just said two.
70.
No. That could be how long I've been on HRT.
Oh,
I think I understand. How far into my 70s.
Okay.
Or it could be both.
Oh, I like this. You're and a mysterious woman she is. Yeah. So the other thing to know about Robin is she's far into transitioning into the woman she knows she really is. So today, Robin's going to share her life and transition experiences with us. And she's going to share some insights she's gathered along the way. Welcome to what my friends lovingly call Betty's hot seat, Robin.
Oh, dear.
Oh, they lovingly say that, so they don't
flash.
Freak out.
It's a hot seat. Oh, my God.
Oh, okay. So let's dive in. Okay. So the first big question is, who is Robin Elise Hamilton? And I'm going to, before you dive in, I'm going to say, the first thing I'm kind of curious about is your early history. Like, where were you? Who were you back then as a kid, a young adult? It didn't have to be a lot, but I think context and where you were in the world is really important.
Yeah. No, that's, and if I didn't blab my age earlier, this context would probably reveal it to everyone. But I grew up in the 50s and in the 60s. I started grade school in 1959.
Okay.
In Louisiana. And then we moved to, in Metairie.
Oh, not too far from where I was.
No, going and driving along the Huey P. Long Bridge was it a big adventure, and crabbing at Lake Pontchartrain, and
my wife's family used to do that. Cool.
Yeah, that was that. Hurricane Betsy, one of those hurricanes. It was just one of those.
Betsy sounds right.
That's where I started school, and then we moved to Mississippi. So that's where I did most of my growing up, in a town that in 1964 the Klan earned the title bombing capital of the world.
What was the town, just out of curiosity?
I don't want to need to say that.
Well, okay. That's all right.
It's north of New Orleans, okay. In Mississippi.
Well, and one of the only rule for Betty's hot seat is you get to not answer any question don't want to answer.
No, I understand. Yeah, but cool. But I think about that, and it's not – the town has changed quite a bit. Since then,
it's not what it was then.
It's not what it was. It's still a red county and a red state, but it's not as red as the county where my sister lives.
Okay, good.
So,
fair.
But it was still, it was very much all of which is to say that I grew up in the era of civil rights, mm-hmm. in Mississippi in the 60s, and I learned or decided to be an ally right away.
Wow.
And so I just sort of, and it just went from civil rights, and then in the 70s, the women's lib and gay rights, and, you know, but then ACT UP and stuff like that, and it just kept going. And that was that, but what was going on at home was if I was growing up nowadays, as a kid, I would probably be non-binary.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did not necessarily say, oh, I'm a girl, I'm not a boy, anything like that. It's just like, I'm me, and I'm perfectly comfortable with boys and girls. I didn't, it was just all one.
Right. It makes perfect sense to me.
Good. Yeah. And my name then was Robin. So,
sufficiently androgynous.
And it was just like, oh, okay. But then when I got into grade school, and I realized about third, fourth grade that girls and boys were starting to segregate themselves by sex and gender, as kids do, as our mm-hmm. social structure imposes on them.
Right.
I realized that I belonged with the girls, but they didn't want me because I was a boy,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't want to be with the boys because they were boys. I mean, come on. No. So I showed them. I became a bookworm and an introvert. And I became a nerd to the point where teachers would come over and get really worried that I was going to grow up to be. They literally told me when I was 10 years old they were concerned I was going to grow up to be a psychopath because I wasn't interacting with the other kids. So I needed to go out there and play kickball with them right now.
Oh, wow. And there was no realization that it was the environment that sort of drove you to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was that. And then coincidentally, being the oldest of eventually four,
mm-hmm.
when my parents' drinking and alcoholism got, I don't know if it was ever in control, but it became noticeably out of control, and I had to take over parenting for my younger siblings pretty early. Mm-hmm. Any inkling that I had of being in the wrong body or wanting to do something about my emerging gender identity, I had to be completely pushed down because I was too busy
surviving
and saving my brothers.
Yeah.
You know? And so, and I pushed it down really hard and really well. And only a couple times when it would creep back up and I was like, no, that ship has sailed. There's nothing I can do about that.
Yeah.
It's like, this is, everybody tells me I'm a boy. I have to be a boy because they don't have time to figure out anything else.
Yeah. And so how many siblings did you have?
At the time when I was growing up, I had two younger brothers. My sister was born after I was in college and had already left home.
Okay. So, yeah, I know. I have significantly older brothers myself, so there's a real big divide.
Yeah.
If you're like 10 years or so separated. Yeah. Okay. So you talked about, you have talked with me about having been a queer ally in your pre-transition times, and you just made a comment about deciding to be a civil rights ally, which I interpret as for African, to support black people.
Right.
So can you tell us a little bit about that in your life? What did you do? What brought you to that?
And the fact that I was a hippie was pretty much an activist act at the time. And I was, constantly getting in trouble for having my hair too long and, that kind of thing. But there were
that would have been 60s, 70s, that time period?
Yeah, this was late 60s and everything. There was a it's not a show about how – we could have another show about the history of the 60s and how it kept me in the closet. But my high school was in considered a very progressive school system in the state of Mississippi in the 60s.
Okay.
So to...
And that's good to hear. I would not have expected that.
They were actually the first school system in the state to have a computer records-keeping system. They were very proud of that. They had an entire room mm-hmm. full of a computer that basically sorted report cards.
That was a big deal back then.
It was a huge deal.
Right.
It was a major thing. So what they came up with was rather than integrate the high school, we had a black high school and a white high school, and rather than integrate them directly, they decided, and I don't know, I think this maybe lasted a couple of years, that one block of classes would be taught in one building and the complementary block would be taught at another building.
Mm-hmm.
And we went on to a long semester program where you basically you took two classes for 9 weeks and then you switched over to two more classes and that kind of thing. That, so you were in one class one time for several hours.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was they bused us back and forth in the middle of the day.
Back and forth
between the two high schools.
What was originally the white high school and the black high school.
It's like the,
okay.
The arts and humanities were at the white high school. The science and mathematics and everything were at the black high school.
This is fascinating.
And they would go
Never
back
heard
and
of
forth.
This.
And so all of a sudden, my peer group, which was amazingly white. I mean, I actually worked at a whites-only soda fountain until I found out it was a whites-only soda fountain.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, one of my best friends, or one of my friends, his family owned that. Another friend of mine, I've just found out recently, ran a radio station that was specifically setting up the continuation of white power. My parents petitioned mm-hmm. for polling things like that. And that was what I was growing up in, dealing with the alcoholism, and so there was no room to be trans in any of that sort of
right.
stuff like that. But what the mixed classes did was they put, all of a sudden we had a lot of black students in my peer group, particularly in the band,
mm-hmm.
because all the black musicians were coming over, and we loved it. It was great.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we would come on when we would all get on the buses together, go back and forth, and we'd all be just, you know, shooting the stuff and, you know, the...
So you got to be band geeks together.
We got to be bandits together.
And for people who aren't band geeks, it's like such a huge bonding experience. Yeah.
They turned us on to Motown.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. You know, the buses with uh-huh. all these, you know, white and black kids, we're all singing Smokey Robinson at the top of our lungs, you know,
uh-huh.
the Supremes, all this sort of stuff. And we're just like, we're getting up in the aisles, and we're trying to dance like
uh-huh.
the Miracles. It was just, and then we looked at each other and said, what are they doing? This is fun. You know, this is great. This is not solving racial problems because we don't have any problems with each other.
You were friends.
It became, it was one of my first confirmations that a lot of adults don't know what they're talking about on most things. So,
wow.
There was one incident that was really brought it all home to me, and this was in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And I was already in junior college outside Jackson, Mississippi. And our stage band, I played string bass in the stage band and bassoon in the orchestra and that kind of thing. The stage band got invited to be part of the pre-show entertainment for a Mardi Gras crew ball in New Orleans.
That's always a big deal in that part of the country.
I've never figured out why they called us, but it was like, this is so cool. Yeah, so we all drove down in our bus from Jackson to New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
smoking cigarettes and drinking beers we weren't supposed to have and all that kind of stuff in the back of the bus. And the band director just shaking his head, going, oh, and then blah, blah, blah. And we got down there, and we unloaded. And we're about to head into mm-hmm. the back door and everything. And they said, oh, wait a minute. He can't come in here. And they pointed to our tenor sax player, who was black. And he said, he's not allowed in here. And what? He said, no, he can't. This is blah, 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 blah. They didn't say whites only, but that was whites only ball. And we all were like, and before we could do anything about it, the band director got in between us and the people and said, you, back to the bus, take your instruments, get back on the bus, wait for me. And then he went in and he read them the riot act. And he just chewed them up one side, down the other. And it's a good thing we weren't there with him because
mm-hmm.
we'd have helped. And he just came back and said, okay, we're going back. And we turned around, we drove back another hour and a half back to Jackson without performing.
Yeah.
And it was just like, and we're sitting out on the park. And
uh-huh.
it was, the ball was in overlooking a park, like a lot of stuff in New Orleans. And we're sitting there and we're all smoking and having our beers.
Mm-hmm.
And watching all the white people going around and going into the ball and their Mardi Gras mm-hmm. things and everything like that. And our sax player was just like, man, it just, and we were just like, man,
mm-hmm.
So that was, you know.
That was pretty, you were right there in the middle of
it. Yeah, that was, and I learned a great deal about support and solidarity and things like that, which mm-hmm. as I'm saying this, turns around and it came back
right.
when I was in New York and AIDS hit,
mm-hmm.
and all my friends started getting sick.
Yeah, and so that kind of leads to the queer allyship
yeah.
that you really had, you were really strong in. You've told me a few stories in your pre-transition time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It, this is all pre-transition. This is
yeah.
all deep denial that I could possibly be trans because, I mean, again, the gatekeeping in the 70s was such
yeah.
that there were certain hurdles that they put in place to establish a diagnosis of transsexualism where I was not going to do that. I could not possibly do that.
Yeah, like what?
One of the things that was very, very rigid is that for a male to female transition
at that time period,
at that time period, you had to live in the target gender for 2 years, earning a living, living exclusively as that, before they would allow you to start taking hormones.
Wow!
So that kind of thing, and then if you, assuming that all progressed and you actually had surgery, you mm-hmm. had to have the full swapping male parts for female parts completely, one or the other, and if you were male to female and had the surgery, you had this, if you were in a heterosexual relationship beforehand, you had to divorce them and basically say that you would be exclusively heterosexual after the operation.
Wow. Well, boy, when you say gatekeeping,
yeah,
those are huge things to have to meet.
And that was, you know, we have learned so much since then.
Yeah.
So much, and that has been significant in part of my deciding to transition on my 70th birthday and coming
mm-hmm.
out that way is because all the things that told me I cannot possibly be a transsexual because I have no interest in ever having sex with men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was just never going to happen.
Right, right.
So
wow. So really, you've seen the whole evolution of how people and the medical, I mean, the gatekeepers,
yeah,
I assume,
yeah,
were the medical establishment.
Absolutely, yeah.
How even their understanding has evolved of gender and what that means and sexuality. So
we've come so far, and so much,
yeah.
And a lot of it, they had to be incredibly careful when they were setting it up
mm-hmm.
that there was no way people could come and say, oh, you're just coming up. You're diagnosing men as transsexuals so that they were making sure that we weren't going to be homosexuals. There was a lot of homophobia built into that gatekeeping.
Okay, I get it now. So that
yeah.
whole gatekeeping was in place to enforce heterosexuality.
Right. I'm heterosexual, and I transition. I hit the mic. I'm heterosexual before transition. I have to be heterosexual after transition. If I'm sexually attracted to women before I transition, and I'm still sexually attracted to women after my transition, what they've done is basically they've created another homosexual and put them out on the streets, and they couldn't do that.
Right.
And there was a lot of. And at that period from the 60s and 70s, the homophobia was baked in. They just didn't – they could not
right.
see past it and everything like that. As a lot of – one of the results of the gay rights movement of the 70s and 80s and everything like that is to realize the lunacy behind a lot of that homophobia. I mean, there were
mm-hmm.
– I saw so many gay men who were terrified out of their brains about AIDS who became the most virulent homophobes in the early 80s in New
mm-hmm.
York because, like, oh, no, and they still, most of them got sick and died anyway.
Wow.
So,
boy, you saw a lot.
Yeah, that was, so when it finally got to a point, I mean, one of the things that still a holdover from that is the whole born in the wrong body concept.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a glib dumbing down of the process that the medical professionals came up with in the 70s to try and explain to lay people what transsexualism was. So
right.
these people are born in the wrong body, and so
mm-hmm.
it's our medical obligation to fix them and blah, 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 blah. We're not born in the wrong body. We're born in our bodies. The wrong part is people looking, you know, you look at a newborn's crotch for a half a second, say, boy, girl, and that follows them their whole life.
That very simple determination.
It's just this is a quick glib. Somebody says, oh, and they make a note on the birth paper, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
As we know now, more and more, that sex and gender are not the same thing.
And they are much more complex.
Much more complex.
And they mix and match a whole lot.
And they mix and match in many different ways.
Wow. So you talked about earlier, like knowing early on that you felt trans. We'll use that word. I'll use that word
sure,
now.
No, that's fine. I mean,
but so when did that, you know, like at what point in time did you really realize that? And then fast forwarding really quickly, what was the straw that made you go, okay, I really am trans?
I kind of kept coming back to it over the years just to see, because I would cross dress now and then, everything like that, and I always kind of would, you know, I'd dress up and I would sit there and go, okay, now what? Okay, fine. And then I would get undressed. So the whole idea of what a lot of transphobic people and trans-exclusive, blah, 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 TERFs and gender criticals and everything like that, talking about the wrong body thing. And they also say autogynephilia, that it's a sexual fetish and there are no trans women. That's just men who like to dress up as women because they want to boink themselves, you know. I mean, just the most ludicrous things that they come up with. And I never felt sexually attracted to me as a woman or a man or anything like that. I mean, it was just like, so the fetish thing never happened, but I would try it and say, well, why do I keep wanting to do this? Why do I keep buying clothes and then getting rid of clothes and buy more clothes and get rid of clothes? I mean, it's a cliche.
But having the clothes and putting them on felt right to you.
I looked at myself in the mirror and I said, that's who I am, but that's unattainable. And I just never felt that that could be, you know, that was always, but I would keep checking. I stuffed myself back in the closet, but it always.
You kept coming out.
Come back out. And so that leads up to the shift of, in the early 2000, working with Judy's husband, Mac, who's trans, and when the bathroom bill, very specifically, when the bathroom bill in 2016 was passed in North Carolina, Mac and I are movie buddies.
Okay.
You know, we would go to movies and these things that my wife and Judy had no interest in whatsoever.
It's good to have a buddy like this.
Yeah, literally, we're just like movie buddies.
And sometimes your spouse just does not care about the stuff you love.
Boys' night out. I mean, I did not know Mac was trans for the first 3 years I knew him.
Mm-hmm.
So my transdar is verklempt. You know, it just does not working. Kaflooey, kaput. That's the word I'm looking for. Anyway, but when the bathroom bill passed, Mac would ask me if I would go with him to the restroom after the movie because he didn't feel safe.
Uh-huh. Makes
and
sense.
And that really brought it home a lot. And so I became, you know, very. And then Sam Patterson, who's in Durham, who we're going to try and get on the show soon, did a show at UNC where I worked about his transition in the 80s and that kind of thing. And so I started, and we had grad students coming in doing graduate level projects exploring their own gender identity and their sexuality. And so I became very exposed to a lot of trans people very suddenly, without realizing it, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, working at it. And so as my knowledge and interaction of them, as I got to know trans people, God, this is like the angels are about to come in and blow with their trumpets and go, I got to know trans people, and so I got to understand trans people a little bit better.
Uh-huh.
So when the political bull caca started getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, all of a sudden it shifted. There was a profound shift in the way I absorbed that, is that it no longer was bad things they were doing to friends of mine. They were doing bad things to me, too.
So you had that realization.
That was when I kind of went, holy smoke.
That's a huge light bulb.
That was like a big thing. And I just like, and I I fought that for several years. I tried writing it out. I would like write things out. Oh, I'm writing a big show about a person who might be trans, but they don't think they are. And so, And it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so finally, nobody's ever done this before. So I want to get a patent and get it copyrighted. But I went online in social media and I introduced myself as Robin Elise. She, her. And the first time somebody said, "Hi, Robin, welcome, girl," blah, 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 I totally freaked out. And I'm 69 years old when this happens. And I just panic and I go off of social media for months and everything. And finally, I came back and tried it again. And I started interacting with people anonymously online, trying out this persona, everything like that. And after a month of that, you know, I kind of went, okay, I have to talk to my wife now. I can't do this anymore. I have to come out to her. And then there was at least 6 months of my, oh, but it's Christmas. I can't do it now. Oh, but it's Valentine's Day. Oh, I can't do it now. Oh, it's our wedding. Oh, I can't do it now. And then finally it was like, I'm going to turn 70 in 2 weeks. I can't keep putting it off. And I said, we have to talk, which as married couples, the universe knows, as soon as somebody says, we have to talk, ding, 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 ding. And we have been working on it together since, and I feel very supported, but it's under construction. So we're not going to talk about what the relationship is doing, but it's just we're still working on it. But that was the lead up to it, as it took a long, 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 long time for me to realize that I actually am trans. And then it took not quite as long, but a long time for me to get to the point to share that with my wife, who is my person. You know, and all things like that. And I convinced myself at the time it's okay to come out and tell her that she married a woman, because I can go back in the closet if she doesn't like it. I have no problem. I'll just go right back in the closet.
Because you've done this so many times before.
I'll go back in the closet. So I just come out to her as trans. And again, if it doesn't work out, I'll go back in the closet and not worry about it anymore. I think we can all laugh at how silly that was, but it was one of the ways that I was able to come out to my wife.
Right.
Is by telling myself that it wasn't permanent.
It gave you an out.
I felt like I needed it out, and that was having been told at a very young age that I hated people, that I didn't care about people, that I was only in this life for my own selfish things, and I would never be happy. I mean, that was ingrained in my head. She zipped open my head. She poured that in, just like the Wizard of Oz, and sewed my head back up. And so one of the biggest parts of my transition over the past couple of years is convincing myself, and I do some days good, some days not, convincing myself that I am worth being happy. That happiness is something I can attain, that I deserve, that I've earned, whatever you want to call it. But that is such a foreign concept to me. That is probably one of the most difficult parts of my transition for me. And I can only speak for me.
Unique.
I am not a spokesperson for the entire trans community or anything like that.
Exactly. So. That makes sense. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
We're going to take a break for a message from our sponsors. Come join us to celebrate National Coming Out Day at our free picnic with Pride. Mark your calendars, save the date. Saturday, October 4th, noon to 3 p.m. at Blackwood Farm Park on North Carolina 86 between Chapel Hill and Hillsboro. It will be a joyful afternoon of community, connection, and courage. Bring your friends, your blanket, and your most authentic self for a colorful picnic filled with food, fun, and pride. Whether you're out, coming out, or supporting someone on their journey, this is a space for everyone to feel seen, safe, and celebrated. Main dishes will be provided, including vegan and vegetarian dishes. Bring your favorite side dish to share. Let's come together out loud and proud. Your story matters, and your presence is powerful. The event is sponsored by the Carolina Aging Alliance, AARP, and the UNC LGBTQ Center, hosted by the Project Engage LGBTQ Plus Senior Resource Team. That's a lot of words. Mm-hmm. The link to register for the potluck is orangecountync.gov/picnicwithpride. Register by October 1st by calling 919-968-2070. Remember the date, Saturday, October 4th, noon to 3 at Blackwood Farm Park. We'll see you there. And back to you.
Great. Thanks, Judy.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Great. So, Robin, you've talked a little bit, really, you've talked a lot about coming out to yourself. And is there anything you would like to say about coming out to other people in your life, like your wife, siblings, friends, and we don't have to go there, but if you feel comfortable with that.
I think that's an important, a very important part of this conversation. As I said earlier, I met trans people and I started to know trans people and a little bit more and without realizing it. So I think a lot of the I don't have the numbers in my head, but the vast majority of people in the United States have never met a trans person that they know.
Right.
So when they have the government telling them that we are an extreme domestic terrorist threat and that we should be institutionalized and we should not be allowed to buy guns, and they keep assigning trans identity to mass shooters all of a sudden, which is total. I mean, the people, they don't know trans people, so
right.
They don't know that that's nonsense.
Well, and I would imagine that kind of rhetoric just makes trans people more protective of themselves and unwilling to expose who they are.
Again, that can be another conversation in another show. But
we'll write that one down.
What I'm doing now is every time I share my story, it's mm-hmm. to help people who are in the closet, who are wondering about themselves, or if they have a loved one who, you know, it's just if I can help somebody get some conversation mm-hmm. going, that's fine. That's why I'm here.
Right. And, you know, the way you were talking about what's going on in your life now, it sounds like you and your wife are working things through right now.
Yes.
And have been for 2 years.
Yeah. And we have no idea how it's going to wind up. Mm-hmm.
And you've been married for how long total? An estimate is okay.
No, I tried to figure it out. We met in 1982. We were both doing an off-Broadway show together in New York. And we got married in 87, 5 years later.
Okay.
So that would be, so our 40th anniversary is going to be 2027.
Wow, congratulations.
And we're backwards from that. So
so you have a lot invested in each other.
Yeah. Again, it's we don't know where we don't know how it's going to finally shake out, but we are going to be there for each other, regardless. We have that core, and mm-hmm. that I'm not worried about.
It's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress as to what kind of shape it takes. And that's her story to tell, not mine.
And that's cool. That's so, part of why I said.
But I can talk about after I did come out to my wife, the next people I came out to were my best friends, which are Mac and Michael, our sound person.
Mm-hmm.
Mac had called us over, called Michael over to help with some computer thing or some sound thing. Michael's a sound designer, professor of sound at UNCW, and was over helping Mac stuff. And I tagged along and everything like that. It was my first time at Mac's house,
mm-hmm.
and we were upstairs in Mac's studio and just puttering around and everything like that. And we got to a point, and he said, "Hey, guys, I need to tell you something." And I'm like, "What?" I said, I'm trans. And this was a couple of months after I'd come out to Anna Marie, so I knew by that point I was not going back in the closet. But anyway,
right.
I said, "I'm trans." And they both just looked at me, literally. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. They looked at me, they looked at each other, and both went, "Finally."
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. No, they did. That was just like, Mac, everything just clicked in Mac's head instantly because of his shared experience with mm-hmm. him. He's going through. He said, "Of course," like that. And Michael just went, "That explains so much."
Mm-hmm.
And then all the time Michael was a former student of mine when I was teaching, and at one point in the conversation I said, yes, I really like being trans. I can use my hands when I talk. And he said, Robin, no. We used to make jokes in class about if you sat on your hands, you wouldn't be able to lecture.
They say the same thing about my ethnic group, Cajuns. Yeah. We can't talk with our hands.
And so, no, they were totally not surprised.
Okay.
They could, in the big book of not surprises, they were like the top of the list of not surprisees.
You know, sometimes I think your friends see things in you don't see as quickly.
And so that was kaboom.
I mean,
bam.
Really good friends.
Yeah, and that's mm-hmm. which is, again, something else that I had to learn is to accept friendship from people.
Mm-hmm.
That was because, again, with all of my complete absence of self-worth growing up and everything else that I have had to overcome and am still mm-hmm. overcoming, friendship was a big part of that. I had friends, but I would never let anybody get really close. You know, there's a long history of mm-hmm. I had a failed marriage. I had a lot of failed relationships, stuff like that, before I met Anna Marie, and things just... That stayed, but it's a long process mm-hmm. of feeling that I am worthy of someone else's love.
Okay.
That has been a really big, huge hurdle. And that's for those of you who are considering transition, you're going to have that same problem too. You know, you have to, I don't think anyone can begin to transition until they decide that they are worth it.
So that makes sense.
That's kind of the thing like that. And so, the next people that I came out to after my wife and my best friends were my siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a wide age difference between us, as we've already talked about. They all live in deep blood red southern states, a lot redder than North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've talked to them about I can't go visit them now because I'd get arrested if I tried to use a bathroom anywhere around there. As a computer nerd, you're going to appreciate this, but I spent weeks trying to set up a Zoom call with my siblings without telling them why, but I just wanted to do that. And they were like, do they have that for Android? Well, I've got it. Back and forth. Then none of it was working. And finally I said, okay, I've heard about this thing my friend Michael told me about called WhatsApp.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, oh, okay. So we all got WhatsApp.
Yeah.
And by that point, because I was going to do this grand family meeting, because I'm the matriarch of the family now,
yeah.
since our parents are gone, I was going to have this big family meeting online and come out to them.
Mm-hmm.
And we never did FaceTime, we never did any kind of face conversations like that, the entire mm-hmm. COVID thing like that. We've just never done that.
Yeah, in our generation, I think, generally haven't done that. And I only laughed because, unless somebody really works with computers much, this stuff is really foreign to them. And in our generation, it's like, why even mess with it if you don't have to? I get it.
But fortunately, and I realize this in hindsight, thinking about it, if I hadn't had those difficulties figuring out a group online meeting, I would have come out in a group online meeting, and that would have been probably the worst thing I could possibly have done.
Mm-hmm.
So what we wound up, once we had the WhatsApp working, as I came out to them individually, and that way they were able to accept my news without feeling pressure from their other siblings about how to receive that news. You see what I mean? It needed to be much more of a one-on-one so I could honor their reaction, give them enough space. And I was so tied up, and they're going to hate me. I have to do it really quick. I'm going to talk to them all at once and then hang up. I don't know, some stupid thing like that, because I couldn't.
Fear is powerful.
Fear was incredibly powerful. And when I realized mechanically I needed to do it one-on-one, I kind of went, oh, that's probably better, and like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked my sibling, who I figured was going to be, big deal. Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah. And that's exactly what he did. And he said, one of my coworkers that I've worked with for 10 years is trans. I went, okay. So, boom, that was done.
Wow.
And then Then I called my sister, who I was the most terrified. I was as terrified of coming out to my sister as I was of coming out to my wife, because I had always been her big brother. I'd always been, we're the one with the biggest age difference, but we're the closest.
Right.
That kind of a thing. I've always been her rock through our parental abuse affected all of us in different ways. We all have eating disorders, but we all have different eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing. But she, being the youngest, she got the brunt of it, and she's, you know, so she and I are very close, and so I was absolutely terrified that I was going to take her big brother away from her. And we've actually had that kind of conversation, but her immediate response was like, oh, I have a big sister. I said, you got a big sister. And it was just like, boom, cool. So that was it, you know, and so again, like my wife, it's an under construction kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But that left my other brother, who poses on his Facebook page with his cigar and his guns. And I actually had to tell him point blank on the phone one time, do not use the N-word in front of me, please. My best friend is black.
Mm-hmm.
And he went, oh, okay. And he never did again. But he just grows up in that pocket where white guys all hang around and they talk about, you know, they refer to black people that way. And he,
right.
And it was just like, and I said, I'm going to come out to my brother who uses the N-word and is in the state that's like the third worst for trans people in the country. It's like, why don't you have your wife with you? I can come out to both of you at the same time.
So is that what you did?
That's what I did.
Okay.
And they came in, and they're sitting in it, and he's sitting in his man cave. He has a man cave in his garage. And he was like that, and I'm like, okay, blah, 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 blah. And she went, and his wife, they both went, oh, okay. And my wife said, oh, was that it? Okay, I need to do laundry. And so she had to go back in the laundry, literally. And I was like, I was so wound up about this, he said. And it's like, and they were just, that's who I am. And they had no problem with that. They were in this incredibly deep red pocket of this very red state. They had no idea that it would be illegal for me to use a public restroom.
Right.
In there. They just had no idea what was going on around there, you know, that
right.
kind of a thing. And so they were like, oh, okay, fine. And my nieces and grand nephew, God, that's right, I'm a great uncle, a great aunt.
We have all those.
I was a great uncle. I transitioned to a great aunt. But, you know, he's getting his driver's license now already. Good.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Okay.
So that was fine. And by that point, those were the people I cared about, my family and my friends.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, it was like, okay, hey, blah, 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 blah. I did come out to my former coworkers at UNC after retired because there were a bunch of them doing a show together, and Michael was doing the sound for it, and I didn't want them to come over and say, oh, how's Rob?
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, oh, she's great. And he would. It would be the first thing he would say, and they would kind of go,
and there you'd
what?
Be outed right there.
And he would be outing me all over the place. So I sat down and I wrote them all I'm trans and here's that blah, 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 and sent it to them. And they all kind of went, oh, okay, fine. So it's just, I have not run into any direct transphobia directed at me. All my medical records have been updated, and I'm Miss Hamilton and Miss Hamilton mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Or there's a couple who just go, oh, okay, and they don't use anything, and they're just sort of
right.
curt
mm-hmm.
And that kind of a thing. And there was one poetry journal I sent in a submission for, a feminist poetry journal, and in my bio is a trans woman, blah, 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 and I paid them for an expedited reading, and, you know, it was just support. It's $2-3, no big deal. It's
right.
Like that. And nothing, and then I got, hi, I'm returning your money. I don't think we can talk to you. Know, I'm not going to do this now. And I could not tell whether it was because you know, I was trans or whether she shut down the magazine or what, and I haven't gone back to look.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just like, oh, so I've, all of which is to say that my coming out is pretty much spontaneous because the people that I cared about coming out to,
right.
I've done that.
And it sounds like, is it right to think that, correct to think that, since you came out to all those people you really cared about, has it continued to be, oh, okay, you're Robin now, and then
yeah,
life.
It's still.
Have they still been okay with it?
Yes,
over time.
Yeah, there are.
That's my question.
We go back and forth as need to. I mean, everybody. We're all evolving mm-hmm. along this way. You know, my sister is. You know, having gotten over the initial news that this is what's going on, they and me have finally gotten to a point where we are starting to acknowledge the loss. What's different? What do we grieve about the things that we can't have anymore?
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that was one of the things we talked about a little
bit. Yeah.
What do you miss? What are you losing?
The things that I miss, which is it's an evolving list, obviously, mm-hmm. like that. But one of the things that I miss the most is not thinking about what restroom to use when I'm out in public. I mean, it's just like all of a sudden, as you two know, I mean, the first time I actually used the ladies' room was one of our meetings at the library, and I had to go, and we weren't done with the meeting, and so full circle, Judy walked me into the restroom like I had been walking her husband into the restroom before, mm-hmm. so like that, and it was absolutely terrifying, and I was so busy looking at the floor, I didn't see anybody's reaction, but Judy said nobody cared, nobody noticed, nobody did anything like that, mm-hmm. but it was just... There is a great deal of tension and fraughtness, I don't know if that's a word, mm-hmm. about being out and here and, you know, in the public doing stuff and having to go to the bathroom. You know, it's like, do they have gender-neutral restrooms? We now have a little list of restaurants we like because they have gender-neutral restrooms.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, there's outside the studio here, for those of you who haven't been to the WCOM FM 103.5 on your AFM dial, studios.
The Carborough Library Complex.
The Carborough Drakeford Library.
Yeah.
They have gendered restrooms as well as a family ungendered restroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been getting really bold because when we broadcast the show, there's nobody in the building or in this part of the building. I go ahead and use the ladies' room.
Good practice.
A little practice like that. I said the hurdle is going to be when my wife and I are shopping at Carmel Mall and I have to use one of the ladies' rooms there.
Mm-hmm.
But I miss that. I miss the ability to be anonymous in a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the things that I loved so much about New York is being in a crowd and nobody cared. Nobody paid any attention to you. Everybody had their own story. But if, in a heartbeat, if anybody saw that you were in trouble, mm-hmm. boom, they're right there to help you. Otherwise, they walk, you know, blah, 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 blah. And
that's a good story about New York City that we all need to hear.
And it's true. It's true. We see things on the news that are particularly fair, you know, the Kitty Genovese story with people, you know, shutting their windows while she's screaming her death throes out on the street.
Well, we hear all the bad stuff.
That.
We always do.
Yeah, but that was – anyway, I love New York. I could talk for hours mm-hmm. about New York.
That's another show.
Another show. But that I miss – so I miss the confidence I had that I could make myself visible or invisible in a group of people. Before I had control over that. I don't have control over that anymore.
Okay.
And I miss that a whole lot.
So kind of being able to take for granted the way you move through the world.
Exactly.
It's like
you can't do that anymore. I no longer have admittedly dysfunctional masks that I had when I was mm-hmm. pretending to be a man all those years. I had a toolbox full of this is how men react.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that means, but this is what it says here, so this is how I'm going to react. You know, all of that stuff, and I don't have it anymore.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting, I think, for you to see how that evolves for you over time.
It is, yeah.
Because I have a feeling there's going to come a day when you don't think about it anymore.
I hope. I agree.
We hope for you.
We will come day. Yes.
Gosh, yeah, so... You know, so you said you've been, I know that I see the time, but we decided we'd go a little longer, right?
No, that's fine. When I start talking, I lose all sense of time.
That's okay, because we're
I'll
watching the clock.
I'll give you a note at the 5-minute point. How's that?
And it's okay. Okay, but so you talked about being in the process of transitioning for like 2 years. So what actions have you taken? And, I mean, you can, it's getting close to the hour, so and we could have another big show about what it takes to do all those things, but what did you have to do?
Well, there's
I know you talked about legal with me. I'm sure there's medical, hormones,
Again, I'm only speaking for myself. A lot of people do very different timelines, and as we bring in more trans people on the show, we'll
hear more.
We'll hear more about this. But my own situation was I came out to my wife early in 23. Mm-hmm. And it was a big enough, bold enough step. Not only – that's what I want to try to be really clear. Not the biggest – a big part of my transition is not just discarding the man disguise that I had been carrying for so many years to reveal the woman that I was born as.
Right.
And everything. But there's deconstructing all of that – gender-based crap and everything. That was only part of it. The mm-hmm. other part of it was getting rid of all the dysfunctional armor that I had built up over the years as a child of abuse from the alcoholism of my parents. And they were both drunks. My father was a passive-aggressive drunk and would just go off and drink some more out of the house. My mother turned all of her rage and fury against her children, and the alcohol allowed her to do that, so she did it.
And you were the eldest, so you...
And I was the eldest, and I had to... So I, at very early age, without realizing it, I developed older sister syndrome, mm-hmm. Which is a whole other conversation, but we're deconstructing all of that crap while I'm physically beginning to transition and think of myself as my true self and not the pretend self that I try to be. That was a pretty big double whammy. So it wasn't the broad plan was that we'd do that, my wife and I would do that for a couple of years mm-hmm. before I did anything permanent. I'd started hormone therapy because I could always stop.
Right.
It wasn't, just to see what would happen as we say no, things like that. And, mm-hmm. But I wasn't going to do anything that I couldn't undo. I could go back in the closet. That same sort of thinking. And it was like that. And then November 5th, 2024 happened. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I had to do everything right away.
By everything, you mean what?
I had to basically establish Robin Elise as a legal, medical, physical entity as fast as I possibly could because of the incoming maladministration in D.C.
Right, and all the restrictions that we anticipated and were correct enforce.
Boom, boom. Yeah, and they just... They're, so we thought we... spent November kind of figuring it out. On the 1st of December, I went in and started the process to legally change my name.
Okay.
Which in North Carolina involves a public posting of your intent on a public bulletin board mm-hmm. at the county courthouse for 10 days so that anybody can – the law is set up very carefully to make sure that people do not change their names to avoid debt or child support or things like that. So there's a lot of convoluted stuff about that that's, from the 20th century and stuff like that.
And things that don't really apply to you, but you had to go through the process. Right.
And I had to – and as part of that – with mm-hmm. the fraud thing is that I had to get signed affidavits from good friends of mine, the McCords, that mm-hmm. we had to all troop into the bank and get notarized that I was of good and moral character and I was not changing my name to avoid debt or blah, 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 blah. And that's part of the paperwork. So it's a process.
Okay.
And so that took December, and I really pushed and you have to get your fingerprints done for this as part of that, and which means you have to have your fingerprints sent to the State Bureau of Investigation as well as the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
So I guess they could check and make sure you weren't
no criminal record
lying about anything you were submitting.
Right. So that was all part of the name change thing to show that I wasn't, a murderer mm-hmm. from some other state trying to change my name, blah, 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 blah. So it's cumbersome, but it does have a logic to it. And I don't have any problems with
right.
that. I immediately started with the in November is when I went in and got the fingerprinting done and mm-hmm. started that because I had to wait. FBI does it online, and you get it in about 4 days. State does it okay. through the nail. So blah, 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 blah. I got my legal name change. Took about 6 weeks.
And I'm sure that had to happen before other
anything
legal
else
things,
hadn't happened.
Right.
Yes, and that happened. I got my legal name change for Christmas last year. Basically, the office was closed on 25th, so I went in on the 27th when they opened it and got my name change paperwork.
Wow. Okay.
And I immediately went to the DMV and the Social Security office and started my process there with the legal name change.
Mm-hmm.
And we
are ready to close out. Oh, are we going to get cut off?
Let's finish this
darlings?
One. No. Let's finish this one.
Give me a second.
One.
I can okay. wrap it up there. So by November 5th, 2025... I will have changed my name, my medical records, my driver's license, my Social Security, my Medicare, my insurance carriers, my end-of-life estate planning, my employment history. And I'm halfway through the physical transformation. And the only thing left by November 5th is going to be my passport.
That's our show for today. Thank you, Robin, for sharing your story with us. You may have provided a page in someone else's survival guide. Again, thanks to WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carborough at 103.5 FM and the Orange County Department on Aging for making Out on the Edge a reality. We'd especially like to thank you, our listeners, for your support. If you have questions or ideas for future shows, or just want to say hi, email us at outontheedgeradio@gmail.com. Now for an inspirational quote to lift your spirits and maybe inspire you on this particular Monday. Some wisdom from Mother Teresa. If we have no peace, it is because we have forgotten that we belong to each other. Join us again next week with Judy McCord, Betty Priu, and Robin Hamilton. Be good to one another.